Yamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Sri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane. Nirvasesa Sunyavadi Paskatyade Shatarane. Vande Hum Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagraja Tam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha. Panchakalpa Chubhischaki Vasindavyevata Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Maha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's August 22nd, 2022, and we're reading in Gita Nagari. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 28. Texts 56 and 57. So if any of you have phones and tablets, if you can get out the verse. Anybody, you want to use the book? 4:28:56. Okay. 4:28:56. Everybody has that? As they say, are we on the same page? Pancharamam Navadwaram Ekapalam Trikotskakam Satkulam Panchavipanam Panchaprakriti Sridvanam Pancharamam Navadwaram Ekapalam Trikotakam Satkulam Panchavipanam Panchaprakriti Sridvavam. Please chant. Pancha Adamam. Five gardens. Nama Dwaram. Nine gates. Eka. One. Palam. Protector. Tree. Three. Koshtakam. Apartments. Sat. Six. Kulam. Families. Pancha. Five. Vibhanam. Stores. Pancha. Five. Prakriti. Material elements. Stri. Woman. Dwavam. Master. Srila Prabhupada's translation. In that city, now this is again spoken by the Lord to basically a devotee. So the Lord is in the form of a brahmana, the devotee is Vaidarbhi, who is symbolically the disciple, the devotee, and she's her husband, who's symbolically the guru. King Malayajwaja has just died. Okay. So in that city, the material body, there are five gardens, nine gates, one protector, three apartments, six families, five stores, five material elements, and one woman who is lord of the house. Move on to text 57. Maitreya Prabhupada's translation. My dear friend, the five gardens are the five objects of sense enjoyment, and the protector is the life air, which passes through the nine gates. The three apartments are the chief ingredients, fire, water, and earth. The six families are the aggregate total of the mind and five senses. Purport. The five senses that acquire knowledge are sight, taste, smell, sound, and touch, and these act through the nine gates, the two eyes, two ears, one mouth, two nostrils, one genital organ, and one rectum. These holes are compared to gates in the walls of the city. The principal ingredients are earth, water, and fire, and the principal actor is the mind, which is controlled by the intelligence, buddhi. Pancharamam navadwaram ekapalam trikotakam kostakam satkulam panchavipanam panchaprakriti stritvavam. In that city, the material body, there are five gardens, nine gates, one protector, three apartments, six families, five stores, five material elements, and one woman who's the lord of the house. Be nice to draw a picture of this. A little graphic. It's giving a verbal picture. My dear friend, the five gardens, actually, my dear friend is not in this translation. So the Lord has been speaking to the devotee over and over again as you are my dear friend. But in this particular translation, in this particular verse, we don't have the word my dear friend. What do we have? What the form of address in the Sanskrit?
Prabho.
Prabho, which is O king. And there's no way that the Brahmana is speaking to Vaidarbhi as O king. So Prabhupada's putting that in the word for word would mean speaking to Prajini Barishat. Narada speaking to Prajini Barishat. Now, it's possible that this is the Brahmana speaking to Vaidarbhi, saying Prabho, which would mean that Prabho is another way of saying friend, but it really isn't. So it's kind of interesting that we have in the word for word, O king, which would again indicate Narada to Prajini Barishat or Sukadev to Parikit. But then Prabhupada in the translations puts my dear friend, and Prabhu doesn't mean friend. It means master, it means Lord. And friend is again related to the other verses, so just interesting. My dear friend, the five gardens are the five objects of sense enjoyment, and the protector is the life air, which passes through the nine gates. The three apartments are the chief ingredients, fire, water, and earth. The six families are the aggregate total of the mind and senses. So, again, we have a very pictorial analogy here. Okay. So, when the Lord first is speaking to the devotee, the Lord is talking of spiritual things. We were two swans, you'll remember that, in the Manasa Lake, and we've been friends, we're eternal friends, and you've fallen from that position, and you've come to the material world. And then the Lord switches to describing the material world. Something very similar, of course, happens in the Bhagavad Gita, and not as an absolute demarcation. But in the beginning, Krishna is talking about how we are the soul, right? And then especially at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, he's talking about the nature of the world. Again, it's not a clear demarcation. You can't say, in the beginning, Krishna is only talking about the soul, and at the end, he's only talking about the world. That wouldn't be the case. But, I mean, it was a conversation. And in a conversation, there's generally some fluidity, as opposed to, say, an essay, where you may have more distinct areas, and you go through and etc., proofread it and so forth. So conversation is a little different. And Krishna's responding to Arjuna's questions. But still, we can say that at first Krishna's talking, you know, you're the soul, and then he starts talking about what is the nature of the world, especially in chapters 13 through the beginning part of 18, Krishna's discussing the nature of the world. So knowing both is important. And we find one of the very special aspects of the Vedic scriptures and Eastern philosophy in general, because this applies also to Buddhism, which of course was an offshoot of the Vedas while denying the Vedas, but still it was an offshoot of the Vedas, as opposed to what we call the Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. In Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, in the scriptures, I haven't studied the Quran much, but at least in the Old and New Testament and when I know of Islam, there is very little discussion of the nature of this world. There's not really an explanation given. Whereas we find in the Eastern traditions that there's just as much time spent on understanding the nature of the world as there is on understanding the nature of the spiritual. Interesting, isn't it? Yes. And here, the Lord is specifically focused on the body, the nature of the body in an allegorical way. Because one can understand this body in tamagun, rajagun, sattvagun, or in transcendence. And then ultimately, we want to recognize this body as a city belonging to Krishna. Now, you talked about how there's a woman as a proprietor. we talked about that yesterday, right? That we're, the jiva is trying to enjoy the material energy. All right, so why is it both? Why is it important to know both matter and spirit? And Krishna also says this in the Gita, I've given you all knowledge, phenomenal and numinous. I've given you matter and spirit. In which of Prabhupada's books do we have very specific statement about that the importance of understanding both matter and spirit? This is a test to see who is reading Srila Prabhupada's books. Well, yeah, in the Gita it's there.
Isn't there a banner in the back to Godhead, right across the top of the back to Godhead?
Right across the banner of the back to Godhead. But I don't know, in the banner of the back to Godhead, it seems to be more turn away from nescience and come to the light of Krishna. So I don't know if that's, I mean, that's a, I think that's an interesting idea, but I'm not sure if that's the right place where we would say Prabhupada says you have to know both. Actually, it's not Prabhupada saying, it's Shastra. But which scripture, which book? I'm sure it's there. I mean, there's verses there, but it's really prominent and explicit somewhere.
Oh, Ishopanishad.
There, you got it.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sotamayi, she's got it. The Ishopanishad. And actually, it's said twice. There's 9, 10, 11, and 12, 13, 14 in the Ishopanishad. Once it says, with knowledge and ignorance. And once it says, sambhutim and asambhutim. What is the ultimate, what is the temporary, and what is the eternal? And of course, yes, Yasoda Dev Das also said Ishopanishad in the chat. So this is also, it's interesting how Prabhupada translates asambhutim in the Ishopanishad. Does anybody remember how Prabhupada translates that? It's a temporary world with its temporary men, demigods, animals. I mean, he's speaking about, David Richaswamy wants to speak to me today about Gurukula and about whether or not our society should be closed, porous, or flexible. And that verse in the Ishopanishad, the way Srila Prabhupada translates asambhutim, basically encompasses things like geography, history, and science. If you're going to know this temporary world with its temporary men, demigods, and animals, you're going to be studying history, geography, and science. Yes? And Prabhupada gave lectures on the seventh canto. Yes, did you want to say something?
Yes, I read somewhere that in the early education of the Gurukula, a lot of subjects were taught to the disciples.
When you say early education in the Gurukula, I would say not in ISKCON. the early Gurukulas did not follow this instruction. In fact, the original minister of education wrote, I don't think I have it anymore, but I had all of the old bulletins and newsletters that were ever done from the Ministry of Education and for Gurukul, and our Minister of Education at the time actually wrote that we want to intentionally not train these children in any knowledge that will allow them to get a career in the world or a higher education. We want to leave them absolutely no choice but to just work full-time for the movement. And I had the father of one of our students years ago also told me that. He said, I don't want you teaching my son anything that will allow him to get a job or to go to university. So, I mean, I saw this as actually very violent. Prabhupada writes in the Asambhutim refers, Prema Kishori Dasi says, Asambhutim refers to one who has no independent existence. Yes, that's the literal meaning, but if you want to look up and put in the chat exactly Prabhupada's translation, that would be nice too. Prabhupada translates it quite interestingly. So actually Prabhupada writes in the second canto of the Bhagavatam that Gurukul is for training in the higher values of life along with specific education, specific training for a livelihood. And Prabhupada gave lectures in Mumbai in 1976 on the seventh canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the section about brahmachari life. And Prabhupada talked about one of the 26 qualities of a devotee, which is daksha. Daksha means to be expert. And Prabhupada was going back and forth between speaking about the children in the Gurukula and the adult brahmacharis who were living in the temple ashram. And he said, they should all be trained to be expert. He said, expert means to know something of everything and everything of something. That all the brahmacharis, this would apply to the brahmacharinis too, of course, should know something of everything and everything of something. So to have a very broad knowledge base and then also to become very expert in a particular field. As Prabhupada writes in the second canto, to have specific training for a livelihood. So we can see a number of reasons why it's important to understand both matter and spirit. To understand spirit in depth. We have Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where Rupa Goswami goes into unbelievable technical categories, subcategories, sub-subcategories, relationship between the subcategories. I just finished teaching the whole Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and I'm telling you, I can't possibly remember all of it. Even though I spent months and months and months studying it in detail to teach it, it's so complex. And then if you go to the next volume, which is Ujjwala Nilamani, where Rupa Goswami takes everything from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and applies it to the Madhurya Bhav, then it's even more complicated. He gives 360 categories of gopis. And he says, this isn't all of them. So, such complexity about spiritual knowledge is given by Rupa Goswami. And of course, in summary form, this is in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Interestingly enough, not so much in Mahaprabhu's instructions to Rupa Goswami, it's there somewhat, but much more in Mahaprabhu's instructions to Sanatana Goswami. And this is a problem of people chatting with me while on Zoom while I'm trying to give a class here. So I'm trying to do a thousand things at once here. So we also have how much detailed knowledge of spirit is also given in the Bhagavatam, say by Lord Kapiladeva. And Lord Kapiladeva in Sankhya philosophy, we also find this. He's giving detailed spiritual knowledge and he's giving detailed knowledge of the way the world works. Especially there, I'd say in the second and third canto of the Bhagavatam particularly. So why? Again, we find, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they don't really give you much of either, do they? They don't give me much information of the spiritual, very minimal. And I studied at the Jewish Theological Seminary when I was young in New York. And, you know, what do you know of God? God is a fire, pillar of fire by night, a pillar of smoke by day, and he's jealous and he's great. And I mean, not much. And there's a Song of Solomon, which they take, oh, that's not literal. It's interesting. The Song of Solomon is very similar to the description Maharishi Chitraketu gives of Sankarsana. But very little about spiritual and very little about material. I mean, it's mostly rules for living. You know, the Jews have 613 rules. Imagine it at our initiation if we had to take 613 vows. So 613 rules, and then there's history. This king did this, this. Of course, we have also history, especially in Bhagavatam. But the other stuff is missing. So why do we need this? Well, first of all, in order to get free from entanglement, you have to understand how you're entangled. Right? You can't just understand where you want to go. Like if you get direction someplace. You know, I've asked my daughter who's picking me up, hopefully Krishna willing, at the airport tomorrow, that I want to stop by at a shop on the way back. My phone is experiencing old age. I need to do a Vedic yajna so my phone can come out in a new body. So I've had this phone for a long time. So I gave her the addresses of two places that we can check out phones. And I said, you know, decide which place you want to go to. It's a different route. You can't go to both. Different route. So when I'm looking it up, what's the directions? I look up what's the starting place and what's the ending place. You can't just look up the ending place. It doesn't work. If you ask for directions, I want to go to this place. Where's your starting location? They can't give you directions otherwise. Right? Am I correct?
Yes.
It's impossible. So if we don't understand how we're entangled, we can't reach our destination just by focusing on the destination. We have to know where we're starting. It's a big part of the picture. We also want to understand the material nature through Shastra so that we can see Krishna in the material nature. Because you could say, well, we could just study material nature through medicine. Why have this analogy of the gates and the gardens? Yeah, and there is an Ayurvedic medicine, like the dhatus and the... Right? Of course, even Ayurvedic medicine is very interesting. I studied Ayurveda for a year because some of my high school students wanted to study Ayurveda, so I had to study it with them. So it's interesting that in Ayurvedic science, and I'm pretty sure the same is true in Far Eastern medicine, Chinese medicine, which is a little different from Ayurveda, but very similar principles, is that even when you're studying biology, there's a spiritual component to it. Bless you. You're not just like modern, what we call modern Western medicine or allopathic medicine. There's no spiritual component at all. You follow? They don't understand the nature of the body in any kind of really systematic way. And the doctors specialize so much. I mean, it's really interesting. I injured my arm a couple years ago. I have a condition called radiculopathy. And Ananda Bhakti, maybe you can give us the whole translation for that verse, not just, because he doesn't just translate it as demigods. If you can just give us the whole translation, that would be nice. So anyway, I have this radiculopathy in my right arm, which is, of course, ridiculous. And so I had a meeting with a vascular surgeon. I had an appointment. So I go to the clinic, and I say, I have an appointment with a vascular surgeon for my right arm. And they said, oh, you have an appointment with the wrong doctor. The doctor they made you an appointment with only treats radiculopathy in the legs, not in the arms. You have to reschedule it. So, this is serious. I'm not making this up. So, this is modern medicine is like this, you know, or like my stepmother's son from her first marriage. He was an ear doctor, and he would always say, "I'm not an ear, nose, and throat doctor. I'm only an ear doctor." You know, and then you have the doctor, the ear, nose, and throat doctor will only look at your esophagus down to your stomach, and then you have to go to a gastrointestinal person to look at the rest of your digest. You know, well, we'll only look at your digestive system to hear. Well, we'll only look at your digestive system to hear. You know, they're so compartmentalized. And one doctor was telling me, you get so knowledgeable in your specialty and you don't deal with anything else, you even forget how to deal with anything else. And then no one's looking at the system as a whole. So it's a very fragmented system. Yes, and often they'll prescribe you something for one condition that then creates another condition in another part of the body because they don't know how everything fits together. So they're certainly not seeing the body. If they're not even seeing the arm as part of the whole body and the ear as part of the whole body, if they're just looking at your arms or they're just looking at your ears, you know, they're certainly not understanding the place of the body in the universe. I mean, that's, forget it. Like, sorry, you're only treating your left ear. You know, you have to go to the other doctor for your right ear. Oh, no, that's not the right verse. Thank you, Sode, but that's not quite it. It's where you've got 13. I think you want 13. You got 12. Get me the next one. So, what's described in our Shastra as far as the body is part of universal understanding. It's connected. It's not disconnected. And we want to be able to see Krishna in the world. Now, why do we want to be able to see Krishna in the world? There's a lot of our Shastra, again, dedicated to this. Which chapters in the Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say how you can see him in the world? 10th and 3 more. 7, yes. That's where Krishna says on the taste of water. No, not 8. We have 10, 7, there's 2 more. 15, yes, Prema Kishori, 15, 1 more. No, that's talking about the nature of the world, but seeing Krishna in the world, but that was good. 11th, well, sort of, kind of, ish. 9th. 9th. That's where Krishna says, I'm the butter, the fire, the offering. Yeah? All right. Okay, so here we have... Okay, that must not be 13, it must be 14. Where's this verse? You know, I'm just going to go look it up because I've asked you and see, I'm just lazy and I should just have looked it up myself instead of asking all of you to look it up. Of course, when you ask for participation from the audience, then everybody remembers things so much better than if you just do everything yourself. That's pedagogy. Alrighty, so let's look this up in Sri Yasho Upanishad. Yeah, here we go. All right. So, and I'll share my screen. It's okay, we can have a little fun, right? It's okay, we're allowed. Don't report me to whoever's the fun police. Okay, one should know, this is text 14. One should know perfectly the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna and his transcendental name, form, qualities, and pastimes, as well as the temporary material creation with its temporary demigods, men, and animals. That's what I thought, demigods, men, and animals. When one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it, and in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge. So, oh, this is Vinash. Okay, Sambhutim and Vinash. Vinasham, what is destroyed. Okay, so sorry, that was my bad. Yes, okay, we got it finally. My bad, we should have been more together with that. All right, so we're seeing Krishna in the world. Why do we want to see Krishna in the world? Why do we want to see Krishna as the taste of water? Why do we want to see Krishna as the fire of digestion, especially relating to today's verses about the body? Why do we want to see Krishna as the life air? Krishna here is talking to the devotee about the life air. Why do we want to see Krishna as the life air? Krishna says that he joins with the life air to facilitate digestion. So he's the fire of digestion and he joins with the life air to facilitate digestion, because the way digestion has to work, right, you chew food and then it has to move, yes? It has to move, becomes what's called a bolus, and it has to move. There's a little flap in the back of the mouth that cuts off the bronchial tubes. So the food won't go in the lungs, it will go in the esophagus. And then it has to move down the esophagus, and there has to be mobility. There has to be, the muscles have to move, and the bolus has to go down. Then it goes through, there's another valve that's supposed to keep stomach acid from going back up to, into the esophagus. Then it has to go into the stomach where it's moving, and then there's another valve out of the stomach into the small intestine. So it's got to move from the stomach into the small intestines. Then from the small intestines, it has to move through the bloodstream. So the nutrients go through the bloodstream and they have to be distributed to every cell in the body. And then they have to pick up the waste products from every cell in the body and bring that back to the kidneys and to the large intestines, right? And then all of this needs oxygen. So there's also that movement of oxygen in the blood. And the blood is bringing back the waste of the air, the carbon dioxide. And Krishna says, I am this movement. If this movement doesn't work right, you're in trouble. Right? And plus he's the fire. You know, for us warm-blooded creatures, 80% of what we eat goes to keeping us warm. Right? Cold-blooded creatures, they can only live in a narrow range of climates, or they have to hibernate in the winter. Yeah? Right? But they don't have to eat very much, like some snakes only have to eat once every year and a half or something like that. Whereas we usually eat two or three times a day because we're putting wood on the fire. But that's Krishna! So why do we need to know that? Because that's where our consciousness is, again, because that's where we're starting from. I'm starting from, I think that I'm this body, and I think that I'm this mind, and I think that I'm these senses, and I think I'm a part of this world. That's where I'm starting from. And so, okay, let's become aware of our breathing for a minute. That's Krishna. He's joining with that air. Let's become aware of the heat in our body. Krishna says, I am the heat and fire. Become aware of the heat in the room. Become aware of the light in the room. He says, I am the light of the sun. I am the light in all luminous objects. The birds are his artistic sense. Do you hear the birds? That's Krishna. So it's very important to understand the world not in a fragmented, mechanistic way, which is how most modern science understands the world. And because they understand it in a fragmented, mechanistic way, what they do to one fragment, to help one fragment, adversely affects another fragment. And because they're seeing the world mechanistically, they're exploitive. Most modern scientific understanding is exploitive. They see the world just as dead matter instead of the body of God. You were saying chapter 11. Chapter 11 in the Bhagavad Gita, we see the universe as the body of God. Kunti says in the 8th chapter of the first canto, O form of the universe, O personality of the form of the universe, O personality of the soul of the universe. Paramatma is the soul of the universe. Just like I am the soul in my body, and then each cell has their own soul. It sells their own soul. We are cells in the universal body. and the universal body has a great soul, which is the Lord. And just like I am the chief soul for all the little cells in my body, so the Paramatma is the chief soul for all of us as well. The universe is a living, breathing organism. So the Vedic understanding is like that. And if we understand that everything is alive, we cannot be exploited. Now you might say, wait a minute, Amila, don't we learn that there's matter and spirit? How you say everything is alive? Is the table alive? Well, yes, not in its own self. So the example I would give, like, well, I just cut my nails, so there's not much there, but there's, you know, the ends of our nails, the white part is dead, yes? But if you touch that, you can still feel it, even though it's dead. You with me? Or the ends of our hair, this is dead, but I can feel it. If you brush against my bun, I know that, I'm aware of it. So I'm aware even of the parts of my body that are dead. Now, if you pinch my skin, I'm aware that you're doing that, and the little cells of my skin are also aware. Are you everybody follow? Those cells are self-aware, and I am aware. With here, only I am aware. There's no living cell in this part of my hair that's aware. So if I interact with the jiva, the Lord is aware, and the jiva is aware. If I interact with the table, just the Lord is aware. And he's not aware like I'm aware of it. I'm aware that I'm seeing it as something outside of myself. But it's part of his body. The trees are his hairs, the mountains are his bones, the rivers are his veins, the ocean is his waist, the clouds are his hair. It's his body. And therefore, I brought this up, I think, again yesterday, but Devamrita Swami was saying on Srila Prabhupada's Vyas Puja that Yukta Vairagya is esoteric. Yeah, we use everything in Krishna service, okay? No, it comes from a very deep, esoteric, mysterious understanding that the universe is the body of God. That everything is divine. There's nothing that is not divine. So we understand the particulars of nature, the modes of nature, the different elements, the different 24 elements, the different workings of the body, as part of studying the body of God. Think of that as part of devotion. Just like Krishna's original transcendent form. We have all these descriptions of his toenails, his calves, his knees, his thighs, his waist, his belly. Lord Kapiladeva gives us all these descriptions, you know, his navel. I can remember if that's Kapiladeva or Lord Shiva. But his navel, it looks like the universe has come out of it and it wants to go back. You know, his shoulders are like a lion. I think that's Lord Shiva's. His chest is like a door. All these descriptions of the Lord's original spiritual form. But there's also descriptions of the Lord's manifest and unmanifest form of the universe. And we have to know both. Because that way we can engage everything in the Lord's service, because we see everything is connected with him, not just theoretically, but emotionally. We feel that way. It's experiential. Now, all of us have to experience our body in the universe. So in Tamagun, people are just like, knowledge in Tamagun, Krishna says in the Gita, is just they know their work. You know, I know how to cook pasta. I know how to drive my car. I know how to work the machine at the factory. I know how to invest money, whatever their work is. They know that. And they don't really think beyond that. In Tamagun, one doesn't really think. How does one thing work with another? What is the real meaning? They just don't think about it very much. I mean, maybe they have some religion, but it's a separatist kind of religion. Here's my life, and there's God over there, and I go and I worship God, and you know. In tamaguna, one basically is not so much higher than an animal. If I have food to eat, and I have a place to sleep, and I have a sexual partner, and I have something to do that I think is useful in the world, you know, like, I'm cool with that. That's enough. You know, in tamaguna, if you can't find your remote control, you just watch whatever the next show is. You're not going to endeavor much. You know, you're not going to try much. Like, if you can eat healthy food, if it's the same price as your unhealthy, if your healthy food's the same price and at the same store, you might eat it. If it's more expensive and you have to go to another store, you're not going to bother. There's not much. There's a real intrinsic laziness in tamaguna. So one isn't really, you know, just don't really think about it. Then in rajaguna, one sees, you know, here's a black person. And here's a white person, and here's an old person, and here's a young person, and this is a dog, and this is a frog, and this is a fish. And you just see the external forms. And in rajaguna, one's philosophy and religion, in rajaguna is mainly civilization, is mostly about trying to be a good person in terms of those designations. I am a white male husband and father who comes from Alabama, and what does a white male husband father from Alabama do to be a good person? You know, I am a Gujarati housewife. What does a good Gujarati housewife do? And that's your dharma. And I also worship God. I have some religion. It tends to be a very sectarian type of religion. And I see the world as given to me by God for my enjoyment, generally in rajaguna. Then in sattvaguna, one is actually able to see that everyone is a soul inhabiting different bodies. In sattvaguna, one can see that the universe is the Lord's body. One can see what these sort of things that we're discussing can be understood by one in sattvaguna. But the difference between sattvaguna and bhakti is one wants to understand this for one's own sense of inner peace and harmony and balance. Yes, I see that everyone's a soul, and I see the universe is divine, and I see that God is a soul. And therefore I am in balance and harmony, and it just makes me feel so happy and balanced inside. So that's the view of one who's in sattvaguna. But in bhakti, we're interested in Krishna's pleasure. Bhakti is far more dynamic, variegated, than sattvaguna. I think of sattvaguna as like you have this little, I think of it kind of experientially, like you have this bright ball of light. It's kind of here, like kind of maybe basketball sized. And maybe it radiates a bit out of you. And you've got this joy that you're carrying around with you and this knowledge you're carrying around with you, but it's very limited. And bhakti is expensive. Anandam buddhivardhanam. Bhakti Siddhanta says that even though the jiva is finite, when they connect with the Lord, their enjoyment is infinite. Or the example I gave the other day, example I really like, the tamaguna is like you have a room darkening shade over your window. You really can't see much of anything. Rajaguna is you have like one of those sheer curtains. You can sort of see, but it's distorted. Sattvaguna, you got a clear window, but it has a frame. And bhakti, you're outside. You can actually understand. I mean, and sattvaguna is amazing. We don't really meet very many people in sattvaguna. We meet a lot of people who pretend to be in sattvaguna. You know, I have some crystals on my shelf and angel figurines, and I do yoga every day. But people who are really in sattvaguna are unusual. Yeah? But bhakti is really expansive. And in bhakti, I see that the city of my body, just like, so we're here at Gitanagari, it's a community. And then you have Port Royal, which is a very small town, right? You don't have a lot of big towns close. It's hard to get here, you know, from anywhere. And then you have some bigger cities, you have Harrisburg, right? And then you go over to Philadelphia, but you bigger city, and then there's really big cities like Washington, D.C. and New York. And then that's part of the country of America, which is part of a continent of North America, which is part of this hemisphere, which is part of a planet, which is part of a solar system, which is part of a galaxy, which is part of a universe. So I have my own private little city going on. Actually, each cell is like a city. If you study anything about the cell, each cell is also like a city. The body of every living being, even the tiniest, tiniest, is like a little city. But it's a city. Each cell has its city within the country of my body. And my body is a city within a bigger country, which is within a bigger country, which is all part of the body of the Lord. So just like we're supposed to use our city for the good of the country. Yeah? We're supposed to, in here in Gita Nagari or in Port Royal, or what county are we in here? Juniata County? Okay. So we're supposed to, in Juniata County, we're supposed to follow the laws of the county. There's county laws. We're supposed to follow the state laws of Pennsylvania. We're supposed to follow the laws of the nation. We're even supposed to follow international laws. And we're supposed to work for the good of the community. Everybody here is supposed to be working not just for their own personal good, but for the good of the community. If you have a family within the community, you work for not just your personal good, but for the good of the family. You work for the good of the community. You work for the good of the city. You work for the good of the county. You work for the good of the state. You work for the good of the country. You work for the good of the planet. You work for the good of the universe. And when we have the vision of bhakti, we understand I work for the good of the Lord. This is His city. I'm not the proprietor. Now, I can't use this city for His glory if I don't understand the city. Therefore, Krishna talks about austerities in the mode of ignorance that give pain to the supersoul, which is interesting. Gopal Hari Prabhu has talked to me about how this really mystified him growing up. How can the supersoul feel any pain? He's full of ananda. If we don't know how this body works, if we don't know how the world works, we cannot use it properly to give pleasure to the Lord, who's ultimately the proprietor. That just makes sense, right? If I don't know what the laws are, I don't know how things work, I can't possibly live in a country for the benefit of the government. I just can't do it. I have to have that knowledge. And that comes down to, on a base level, varnashram dharma. What is my psychophysical nature? Because each of us has a little different city. I mean, Krishna's giving here a generic understanding. But my city is a little different than your city. My city council is a little different. It just is. My mind's a little different from your mind. As Prabhupada would call it, the psychophysical nature. So exactly how my city serves the greater society is going to be a little different. Right? Each city in Pennsylvania contributes to the good of Pennsylvania in a little different way. Each state contributes to the good of the country in a little different way. It has different products. Mississippi isn't going to produce the same products as Montana. It can't. So we understand, what's my psychophysical nature? That's our varna. Where do I fit? Our varna is, how do I fit in the universal body of God in this life? Am I contributing to the heads, the arms, the digestive system, or the locomotive system? Am I producing wisdom and truth for the society? Am I producing honor and justice and ethics and morality and care and protection for the society? Am I producing wealth in a sustainable, regenerative way for the society? Or am I producing all the beauty and function for the society? What's my place? And then what's my place in terms of my biological life cycle? My body also changes with time. My contributions to the universal body when I was 7 is not the same as when I'm 27, is not the same now that I'm 67, and if I live to be 97, it will be different then. And therefore, that's the ashram system. My contribution to the universal body when I'm 7 is to study and prepare. When I'm 27, it's to have children and generate wealth according to my varna. When I'm 67, it's to perform austerities. When I'm 97, I better be purifying my existence. So one is going through these different stages of life. So one has to understand these things. The whole idea of varna dharma is I take my psychophysical nature and I connect it with the Lord. That's the difference between varna and varna dharma. And the whole idea of ashram dharma is I connect my natural place on the biological life cycle with the Lord. Everybody, I mean, unless you die young, everybody goes through these things. And this tilak mark, what does this mean? My body is a temple. My city belongs to God. Every city, every village, every county has a sign. Entering Juniata County. I bet you there's signs, right? On the roads. There's signs on buildings. The name of the building. Signs on cities, signs on states. When I was a kid and we drive through the tunnel from New York to New Jersey, I always was looking for the sign. The demarcation between New York and New Jersey. So this is our sign. My body already belongs to God. This is my sign that I recognize that. I accept that. My body belongs to God. It is His city. And then, of course, I do my best to use the body that I'm in. I'm not the body, but I do the best to use the body that I'm in for His glory, for His pleasure. And interestingly enough, doing that is part of developing my inner spirituality and my inner relationship with Krishna. Those two things are not absolutely separate things. Because if I'm really developing my inner relationship with Krishna, whatever I may be, ultimately a peacock, a cowherd boy, you know, Krishna's necklace, or whatever it is, I'm also using the city that I'm in for His glory. All right, so I think we're at time to greet the deities. Thank you very much for your patience and tolerance and for being very participatory. Thank you all for your hospitality here at Gita Nagari. And I felt very welcome and very loved. I know Bhakti Tirtha Swami really wanted to have a community where the six loving exchanges are prominent. So I have certainly felt that in terms of being given to me, and I hope that I have also given some loving exchange to all of you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.